Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello, and welcome to the Spike Podcast. I'm thrilled to be back with Spike columnist Luke Gittos.
Hello.
And making his pod debut, Michael Murphy, writer for The Telegraph and presenter of a new documentary called Guardians of Israel. Welcome.
Thank you.
We've got absolutely loads to talk about today, from the farmers' protests in London to the ongoing fallout from the Alison Pearson scandal and the latest outrages from the European Convention on Human Rights. But first of all, I wanted to let everyone know about this exciting new product, Beckett's Whiskey. Do you want to give us a little cheers here?
Cheers.
So people may remember Beckett's Gin, who sponsored us last year. We're delighted to have them sponsoring us again. And now they've developed this fantastic new English malt whiskey. And it's unique. It's the first malt whiskey in the world to be matured in a slow gin barrel. So it gives it a kind of unique taste. Loyal viewers and listeners of Spiked can get 20% off this whiskey and many of Beckett's other products if you just go to beckettsgin.co.uk/spiked. For those of you listening at home, that's BECKETTSGIN.co.uk/spiked. Now, on with the show. So thousands of farmers turned up in Whitehall this week, protesting against the Labour government's inheritance tax raid in the new budget. Luke, do you think the government actually anticipated the fury that this has created? It seems to have really caught them off on the back foot.
That's a key point. Labour promoted themselves as a government of competence and the adults being back in the room. But I don't think they appreciated the impact that this policy would have. So in the budget, they announced this alongside reforms to business property relief. So agricultural property relief and business property relief effectively at the same time, and effectively announced the same changes to both. In other words, they would remove the relief over for property over £1 million. Now, the rationale behind both of these reliefs is that when a business owner dies or when a farmer owner dies, you don't necessarily want to completely destroy the operation of either the business or the farm. But Labour appear to have imagined that these two things can be reformed in exactly the same way while having absolutely no impact. What they fail to appreciate is that the position, firstly, of tenant farmers, which is the kind of group that's grabbed the headlines in recent days. And tenant farmers are obviously are people who work a farm that they don't own. And so they're in a position where the owners of that farm will have to basically sell the tenanted land that they're on in order to pay their inheritance tax bill. And that's a big difference. That situation does not arise in the context of a normal everyday business. When a business owner dies, there is normally someone who can step in or someone who can, the business can operate relatively independently. It's this kind of nuance that I think Labour have completely and utterly missed. It's worth remembering that these reforms were worth about worth a tiny amount of the money that they had to raise, about 500 million.
Yeah, 500 million is nothing.
Absolute pennies. And they've managed to completely lose control of the narrative over it. So I can't imagine that this was a principled stand that they wanted to make. I think this is just something they didn't at all anticipate. Mm-hmm. And so I think more power to the elbows of the farmers. This represents a real impact for people who have, you know, a long-standing emotional and personal attachment to their work, which is just going to be ripped up because of a relatively insignificant addition to the budget. I'd be furious as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's this kind of narrative coming from the Labour cheerleaders, if not necessarily the government itself, that is painting these farmers as rich. You know, if you own more than £1 million worth of land, then you must be some sort of aristocrat or, you know, living it up. But farmers earn basically nothing a lot of the time. They're very, they might be asset rich, but they're very cash poor.
It's a bit like accusing the kulak who owns three chickens of being a member of the bourgeoisie. it was quite striking to see a sort of sea of tweed and barber jackets in central London. You almost forget that this is the sort of deep England that we that really is the bread and butter, quite literally, of the country. And so I thought that was that was very moving to see all of those people in one place. I think you're right, Luke, about the benefits as opposed weighed against the opportunity cost of this for farmers, for families, businesses. It seems like a sort of self-inflicted own goal for the Labour Party. I thought it was interesting to see that the messaging has been so unorganized. So sometimes they come out and they say, well, we love farmers. And then they'll come out and say, well, no, this is to close a loophole because farmers are exploiting this. Or they'll come out and say, well, you know, this is going to help the NHS, whereas it will only finance about 3 days of our bloated NHS. And so on and so forth. So I think it's a sign of a Labour government that's lost control of its narrative and is maybe progressing with policies that the civil service are keen on, maybe as a result of NGOs or think tanks that have fed in these ideas. We've seen this with Winter Fuel, seen this with the handover of the Chagos. I think we're seeing a sort of government run by civil service, not by Downing Street.
Yeah, and you know, it also seems to betray a detachment from, you know, not just rural communities and how they live, but sort of the material world, how it works, how farming works as a business, as a process. Mm. I mean, you see similar with the bans on oil and gas exploration. You get the sense that a kind of urban elite in charge of Labour believe that electricity appears magically out of the socket. And our food appears magically in an Ocado delivery van. Mm. There's a common theme there, I think.
Definitely. I mean, you heard some of the people being interviewed on the protest talking about urban MPs trying to get their heads around how the countryside works. And I think there's probably a lot of truth in that. And hopefully the country-based MPs, especially those in Labour, will see that their seat must be under threat here, and they will concede, they'll make some concessions with regards to the detail of this policy that will make a difference. But I think you're absolutely right, Fraser, that it's worth remembering that farmers in this budget weren't only hit with the reforms to inheritance tax, but there were other cuts to how they were being paid, for example, the tapering off from the EU subsidies. So there were slight adjustments to that, and then also the increase in national insurance, because farmers obviously employ people. So it justifiably felt as though they were being targeted for absolutely zero reason. And I think you're right that it's this complete detachment from how we get food onto our shelves. It's not fanciful. You know, when we're talking about food dependency, you know, when we're talking about real issues with regards to supply chains across the world, we should be doing everything we can to make sure we have food security. And it's a relatively minor tinkering to the budget with potentially huge impacts on the way we live our material lives.
And Michael, I mean, in a way, Britons are late to this, or British farmers are late to this. There's been a huge rebellion of farmers all across Europe, mostly in response to EU rules. A lot of that to do with the environment, a lot of net zero rules, making farming impossible over there. I mean, you were in Ireland and you saw some of the farmers in protest.
Yes, earlier this year when there was sort of the farmers in Paris got the French capital city in a kind of rear naked chokehold, of block off all the main arteries to Paris. There was a show of solidarity from the Irish farmers. And so I went down and spoke to them, and you know, they essentially echoed a lot of the concerns of the people we saw out on the streets earlier this week, where, you know, farming is not a profitable business. The margins are very narrow. There's new tax infringements on their use of fertilizers and pesticides, and regulations around how much fallow land they need to leave, and it's making an already difficult job nigh on impossible. And so the conditions are being set up as well with this tax to, you know, essentially force them to sell out. Mm. I think that the big winners of that will be probably large multinational companies that will scoop up that as a and get a good deal at that.
So it's been over a week since the Telegraph journalist Alison Pearson had the police knocking at her door, informing her that she was being investigated for stirring up racial hatred. Luke, there's been some recognition from the establishment that this is maybe a bad idea to have police knocking on journalists' doors. But there's also been a kind of liberal sneering about it, you know, as if it's almost okay. You know, what does she expect? These are the consequences of having the kind of views that she does. What have you made of the discussion in the wake of it since?
Well, I think there's been room for optimism. I think it's right to recognise that, you know, Keir Starmer said that the police should be investigating crimes, not tweets, which is quite unusual for him to say, given he was the director of public prosecutions at a time when these sorts of prosecutions were absolutely rife.
He led the first Twitter trial, didn't he?
He led the first Twitter joke trial. And was found by the Court of Appeal to have misinterpreted the law. The CPS was under his leadership. So he has obvious form in this area. But nonetheless, you know, there were questions asked about it in the House of Commons. There was a relative uniformity of view from most MPs that this was a bad thing to have happened. But you're right in the sense that there has been another set of opinion, which is sort of like, well, what's the big problem here? What's the big issue? And I think to understand what the big issue is, you need to look arguably even beyond Alison Pearson's case and look at the wider environment here, where we have a combination of a few things. One is laws relating to speech, which are very, very broad. Mm. So the Online Safety Act, the Protection from Harassment Act, other pieces of legislation like this create offences that are very, very broad in their application and potentially apply to a very, very wide range of what people say online. You then couple that with the police, who are given the room to interpret this legislation and interpret the circumstances at which it's appropriate to show up at someone's house and accuse them of a crime, or in some circumstances even arrest them for a crime. So the combination of these two things mean the police have to make some really awful decisions about when to show up at someone's house and question them about an offence. And the other element of this is that when the police receive a complaint, they are duty bound in most cases to follow it through. Mm. So if someone with a vendetta spots something that someone has said online and thinks that it's offensive or grossly offensive, then they can contact the police and have that person at least have the police show up at their house, in some circumstances have them arrested. So that is a really problematic situation. And I can say that there are cases currently before the UK courts that are working their way through now that I think would trouble most members of the public. If they saw what the substance of the complaint was, they would be worried about that. And what I think we're going to start seeing, and I've seen it reported today, that we're starting to have some of the first jury acquittals of cases involving tweets sent in the immediate aftermath of the Southport attacks. So we're starting to see juries interacting with this evidence and actually saying, no, we're not going to send this person to prison, or we're not going to convict this person because of what they said online. So thankfully we have the jury as the sort of last bastion of liberty here. But it is problematic that the police have such broad powers, and I think their skewed focus and their skewed priorities mean they're following through with more of these complaints than ever before. And that's because it's worth remembering, policing tweets is easy. Policing theft, fraud, burglary, violence is a lot harder.
Yeah, and often doesn't seem to happen at all.
Exactly.
Michael, do you think this raises that old question of two-tier policing? And in fact, the irony is that the tweet that we suspect Alison Pearson was being investigated over was about two-tier policing. Her suggesting the police were essentially posing with a group of people she thought were Palestinian protesters were actually protesting for a Pakistani political party. Does it raise that issue in your view?
I think so. I think over the 80s and 90s, and then especially with the Equalities Act in 2010, we saw the emergence of a separate category of crime, which is a hate crime. And, like Luke was saying, the parameters for some of these speech codes that come up that may fall under hate legislation are so broad that they are subjectively interpreted by forces that we know, police forces around the country that we know are ideologically captured. You know, we see them, we see the way they respond to pride marches, and we see the way they, wear soft gloves when they police things like the anti-Israel protests that have been making their way through the capitals each weekend, as opposed to, say, you know, lockdown protests. Or and so we know that there's an ideological bent in a lot of these organizations, and so if they're given carte blanche, it's going to lean towards protecting certain groups and not others. Like I find it hard to believe that if a minority had tweeted that a group of people on an Israel march were Islamophobes, that we would have seen an investigation like we have with Alison Pearson.
Yeah, another issue that's also been raised by this is the non-crime hate incident. Now, Alison Pearson initially said, perhaps misremembering or mishearing, that she had been accused of a non-crime hate incident. That doesn't seem to have been the case. It was an actual crime that she was being investigated for stirring up racial hatred. But nevertheless, it has opened up this conversation. And we've learned recently in the past week that many children have been accused of non-crime hate incidents, including for saying one of their fellow pupils smelt like fish. Another child called another a retard, and this was logged against their essentially not quite criminal record. I don't know how your non-criminal record, I suppose. We don't even have the words to express these kind of Orwellian phenomenon.
Yeah. So what's happened over the last decade or so is that the police have developed new ways of recording things that they can't put on someone's criminal record. So by way of example, if you're accused by someone of harassing them, they can issue what's called a harassment letter. And that harassment letter will stay on the police's internal record, but it won't go on your record that's available if you have, say, a DBS check. So it won't be checkable by an employer or anything. And the non-crime hate incidents came to limelight with the case of Harry Miller. So that was a high court case where they challenged the lawfulness of this recording. And we thought at the time that was a real step in the right direction, because Miller was that the case that was delivered by the High Court in Harry Miller's case was a real essay on the virtues of free speech, and was a real summation of all the reasons why we have laws to protect freedom of speech in this country.
I think that the judge famously said, "We've never had a Stasi or a Cheka in this country. What's going on with non-crime hate incidents?"
Yeah,
but they carried on recording them anyway.
Yeah, exactly. So they found a way to carry on doing it. I do think that this has got to be an area for some sort of reform. I think there is a lot of attention coming on these now, and hopefully the Pearson case will. Although you're right, it wasn't an allegation of a non-crime hate incident, but hopefully this will be a hook to get these back into the public discussion. And so as part of a broader debate around reassigning police priorities to crimes rather than non-crimes.
It seems like everyone these days is starting their own side hustle, and who can blame them? Who wouldn't want a bit of extra cash and a bit of extra independence? Now, I know it might sound daunting trying to start a business, but if you do know where to start, it won't be long until you start hearing this. Yes, that is the sound of another sale on Shopify. Shopify is the all-in-one commerce platform for starting, running, and growing your very own business. Whether it's vintage jackets or tennis rackets, Shopify makes selling online and in person easy, so you can focus on the thing that matters, growing your own business in a way that suits your lifestyle. Shopify gives you all the tools you need to succeed, whatever your business idea, whatever your experience, and whatever your age. It covers all of your sales channels, from a shopfront ready point of sale system to social media marketplaces like Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. Shopify gives you complete control over your business, and you don't even need to learn any new skills in design or coding. And that's not all. Shopify goes the extra mile to make sure your business goals are never out of reach. One of the great perks is an extensive business course library and 24/7 help. It's time to get serious about selling and get Shopify today. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up now for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/spiked. Just go to shopify.co.uk/spiked to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.co.uk/spiked. Sticking with the law and the courts being a bit of a problem, let's talk about the latest outrage stemming seemingly from the European Convention of Human Rights. So people may have read recently in the Telegraph about a Congolese man who raped his stepdaughter, but couldn't be deported on the grounds of his Article 8 right to a family life under the European Convention on Human Rights. Now, this is especially strange because it's obviously his own family who are endangered by his presence in the country. Luke, what do you make of this? I mean, often it's not quite so simple to pinpoint the blame for these cases. It could be the ECHR, it could be British judges themselves, not, you know, losing all touch with common sense. But what do you make of this?
Well, it is difficult. So what one, I don't know, I'm afraid, the detail of this particular case. And there's obviously evidence that goes in on both sides. But one thing I can talk about in general is that these are decisions normally of the first tier immigration tribunal, which is the first tier that considers these sorts of claims. And this case is likely to be appealed and go up to the Court of Appeal or the one of the upper immigration courts. So it's worth waiting to see whether this stands. But in general, it shows a problem with human rights legislation and human rights jurisprudence, because you sort of create these rights that sound good in the abstract. You know, a right to a family life sounds like a good, positive thing.
No one wants families being broken up by the
state. No one wants families being broken up by the state. The problem with it is that laws have a way of creating very dangerous precedents. So we now have a lot of case decisions from Strasbourg and from the courts in this country, which have led human rights laws to be shaped in a way which a lot of people find very strange and in some situations quite dangerous. So we've seen recently, you know, asylum claims making the headlines, you know, that we just would not think are meritorious, and that people remaining in the country who really, really shouldn't be here. And that is why this human rights legislation is under scrutiny now more than ever before. I mean, it's worth mentioning that this has now been part of the European Convention was part of the Tory psychodrama for the last 5 years. Robert Jenrick famously making the case that we should be leaving and basically running his leadership campaign on the basis that we should leave. But no party seems willing to tackle this head on, because it would be quite a big job to get us out of these institutions and conventions now. But the kind of status quo is just allowing these cases to continue to drift. And I think there's just going to be more of these results that come forward that are outrageous on the face of them. We'll see how this individual case plays out. But until a political party is willing to grasp the nettle and actually reform this area, I think it's just going to keep happening.
And Michael, you've written recently about how some of these cases are dealt with in Europe, because needless to say, the title says it's the European Convention on Human Rights. How do other governments, you know, react to these kinds of decisions? Do they tolerate them? Do they also bow down to them?
Well, the French just pick and choose a la carte. The ones they like, they keep. If they don't like it, they'll ignore it and they'll deport somebody, often within a week. As we've seen several examples recently, including a hate preacher earlier this year who was deported tout suite. After he made derogatory remarks about the tricolour flag. So I think that, you know, in Britain, we're constantly going on about our international reputation and the need to sort of appear like good boys and girls in the international sphere. But it's these laws are, you know, we seem to apply a standard of applying these laws in Britain that Europe doesn't hold itself to. And also, I think that the ECHR element, Luke, you might be able to add to this, is a slight red herring, in that the relevant parts of that law are pretty much copied verbatim into British human rights law. Yeah. And so we would have to extricate that as well in order to solve the problem.
Yeah, that's right, isn't it? I guess a lot of these are codified in the Human Rights Act anyway.
Yeah, so the Human Rights Act is a piece of UK legislation that was passed by the new Labour government. And what it did was it incorporated the convention rights into the UK law. I mean, it created an obligation for all courts to consider European human rights jurisprudence in their decision-making and impose that same obligation on all public bodies. So basically all courts and all public bodies have to make their decisions in accordance with convention rights. And that means considering the convention rights, the jurisprudence, the decisions of the European Court of Human Rights. So if we repealed the Human Rights Act, then that obligation would fall away and we would then have a debate around how to protect those freedoms with domestic law.
Yeah.
Of course, a lot of those freedoms existed before the passage of the Human Rights Act. You know, a lot of the laws that the European Convention actually borrowed a lot of the English mm-hmm. common law when it was, and a lot of the people who drafted the European Convention were English lawyers. So it's not a surprise that the English common law gave the European Convention a lot of the rights that it now embodies. So we have nothing to fear from leaving the convention. It's just a slightly big political project that no one is willing to grasp the nettle of.
And finally, Luke, why does it seem as if the Article 10 right to freedom of speech never seems to be enforced with as much vigor as any of the other articles in the convention?
Or indeed the article not to have your culture diluted or bulldozed over?
Well, I think on Article 10, the recent case of Ziegler, which involved the protesters, protesting at an arms fair. Mm. And that was actually a step in the right direction, in that the Supreme Court recognized that when you prosecute someone for a criminal offense, it's got to be proportional to their right to free expression. So Article 10, but the reality is that Article 10 plays very little role in the kind of case that we were talking about earlier. You can't really argue that it's because we have a criminal, piece of criminal legislation that the police are obliged to investigate where there is an alleged violation of, the court's likely to say, well, it's perfectly proportionate for the police to do their job and investigate those crimes. So it's difficult to have Article 10 play any role in the kind of cases that we were talking about earlier, Alison Pearson and others.
Right, now let's talk about the new Jaguar ad everyone's talking about.
Have they let Anna Wintour as like a sort of guest editor of Jaguar's adverts?
So is that, there isn't, it's created a lot of, this advert's created a lot of fuss, quite understandably. There's more than 100 million views of that on X, 88,000 comments. I don't think a single one of them is positive. This is this Jaguar's Bud Light moment, do you think, Luke? I mean, it's...
I consider this an egregious act of violence against the Jaguar brand. Mm. I think that what might have happened is that they've got some marketing agency in saying we need to become more relevant, we need to become more engaged with Generation Z. And they've said, well, get rid of any reference to cars, get rid of any reference to speed, to luxury, and just plaster it with diverse people. And then insert a series of platitudes, apparently broadcast from Mars, and you've got yourself an effective advert. I do hope that this is a slap in the face for Jaguar, who do have, by the way, one of the most iconic British brands. I mean, that logo encapsulates everything about that car. You look at that logo, you know exactly what the brand means, what the brand is all about, you know about its history, its story, you know everything about it. And they seem to have scrapped it for this peculiar montage that might as well be advertising anything. I mean, it could be advertising a mobile phone, who knows? Mm. I just think it's such an extraordinarily strange decision.
Yeah.
And I hope it will die a death, but who knows?
I mean, Michael, do you think they've sort of missed the moment? Like this, maybe this advert could have played well in 2020, but people are over woke now. People are bored of it. Certainly we've seen Bud Light as the classic example of firms actually paying a price for this kind of marketing. What were they thinking?
Yeah, I mean, there might be they're just late adopters to a fad or a mania that's spent itself, is now on the wane, or it could be just a clever marketing ploy that any press is good press. Mm. You know, if you piss people off, get people talking about something, it can get your brand out there nonetheless. So whether it's going to put somebody off buying a Jaguar, don't know.
It seems like they're almost like targeted precisely the wrong audience, because as you said, Luke, you know, it's, you think classic British sports car, sophisticated, elegant, and this is, you know, almost aimed at like a non-binary art student who wouldn't dream of driving a car and would balk at the idea of,
Yeah, it's like, it's not the target market for Jaguar, is it? And, you know, I think it's probably right to say that this might have a limited impact on its established market wanting to carry on buying Jaguars. But who knows? I think it's just an it does show a degree of contempt for their established market as well. I do think that, you know, owners of Jaguars and people who are loyal to the brand are going to look at this and think, what the hell is going on? And that should worry a manufacturer like that. It should worry a brand like that, that they're doing conscious vandalism to and a conscious slap in the face to the people that they've been selling to for a very long time. And if you think about marketing around some of the, you know, not all big brands have gone for this. If you think like other big luxury brands,
yeah,
they're not all trying to plead to a new generation. They run, they understand that they're targeting a particular layer of society, and that that's perfectly legitimate. Mm. And you know, the more that this kind of woke advertising takes over, and the more it gets into people's heads that this is where you need to be headed, I think more and more, the real risk is that more and more of these great brands will just fall by the wayside and die.
Definitely. And finally, Michael, before we close, do you want to tell us a bit about the new documentary that you're in?
Sure. Thanks, Fraser. So it's called The Guardians of Israel. It's a 40-minute documentary on a new platform called Outpost, which you can find on outpost.net. And it's essentially about the war from Israel's point of view. We spoke to politicians, government ministers, trauma surgeons treating soldiers coming in from Gaza, people in the abandoned ghost towns in the north of the country, just to essentially tell the story of a people living in a perpetual state of alertness, many of whom are internally displaced in their own country, which you know, not a lot of people know about. Actually, is the, you know, that since the start of the war, from 200,000 to just under 100,000 people have been refugees inside Israel, and just to show why they're currently in Lebanon, why the war is still going on.
Brilliant. Well, look forward to checking it out.